This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Saudi warplanes bomb civilian targets in Yemen after the Yemeni army fires missiles at multiple Saudi targets, including Aramco facilities, on the 7th anniversary of the war. EU coordinator Enrique Mora says he is visiting Tehran in the coming hours to close the gaps in the ongoing talks on the revival of the Iran deal. Also ahead, Russia asking for explanations from Washington over Hunter Biden's alleged role in financing U.S. bioweapons program in Ukraine. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Deadly Saudi air raids on Yemen continue unabated. Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against the war-wrecked country, targeting Yemen's facilities in response to Friday's missile strikes by the Yemeni army. At least 8 people, including women and children, were killed after the Saudi warplanes carried out attacks targeting residential areas in the capital Sana'a. Several others were also wounded. The warplanes also raided oil and electricity facilities in the port city of Hodeidah. Local sources say the raids caused massive damage to residential neighborhoods and civilian facilities. A number of areas in the province of Sa'da were also targeted. The attacks happened after the Yemeni army targeted Saudi state-run oil giant Aramco facility in Jeddah and other vital sites in the capital Riyadh with missiles. The army said the attacks were carried out on the eve of the 7th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh. The targeting of Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries with a large number of drones. The targeting of Aramco in Jizan and Najran with a large number of drones. Targeting locations in Jizan and Dahran in the south, as well as Abha and Khams Mashit with ballistic missiles. The armed forces will continue to carry out attacks on important targets with the aim of breaking the siege.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. The army says it will continue its retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi-led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the words washing in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's been nearly a year since Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal began negotiations in the Austrian capital to restore the accord. Now the European Union coordinator for the talks says he is traveling to Tehran to help close the remaining gaps on reviving the agreement known as the JCPOA. Enrique Morris said he would meet with Ali Bogherikani, Iran's top negotiator, in the Vienna talks later today. Meanwhile, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. will increase pressure on Iran if talks over the JCPOA revival fail. Iran has stressed that it is ready for a good agreement if the U.S. removes sanctions verifiably and provides guarantees that it will not abandon the deal again as it did so in 2018. Iran has dismissed as news fabrication a British media report about a secret agreement between Tehran and Moscow over the revival of the 2015 deal and Western sanctions on Russia. An informed source with Iran's foreign ministry says the report published by the UK newspaper Daily Telegraph is in synchronization with scenarios planned by the Western security institutions and in line with their psychological warfare. It added that Tehran's position has been clearly declared by the Iranian foreign minister during his recent visit to Moscow. The UK Daily claimed that Tehran has offered to help Russia evade the impact of Western sanctions in return for getting Moscow's backing for a new agreement with a P4+1 group of countries on the revival of the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said in Moscow that Russia presents no obstacle to reaching a new agreement on the JCPOA revival. He underlined that there is no link between the developments in Ukraine and JCPOA negotiations. It's the 31st day of the Russian offensive in Ukraine, with Moscow saying the first phase of the operation is mostly complete. Russia's defense ministry says it will now focus on full liberation of the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. That's where two self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk are located. According to the Kremlin, 93% of Luhansk is now under Russian control. Meanwhile, a Russian negotiator says no progress has been made on major political issues in the Moscow-Kiev talks. Ukraine's foreign minister is also saying that the talks have been very difficult, but his country will not back down on its main demands. They include the ones related to security guarantees, ceasefire, and Ukraine's territorial integrity. 1 month into the conflict, the United Nations Rights Office has confirmed over 1,000 civilian deaths, saying the real toll could be considerably higher. Johnny Miller, our correspondent in Kiev, is on the line. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. Hope you're well. So will you please give us an update on the situation on the ground first?
Well, in Kiev at the moment, everything is quite peaceful. The last strike here, missile strike, was about 3 or 4 days ago at a shopping center. There hasn't been any strikes since. The sirens in Kiev blare a few times every day. You can hear bombing in the distance. But the hope here in Kiev is that Kiev won't be attacked at all. The Russians have said that the first phase of their, as they say, special military operation, the war here, is over, and now they're going to concentrate on the east, the Donbass region. There are some reports that the Ukrainian army has taken back some towns outside Kiev. Those are unconfirmed, but it looks like at the moment, as the Russians are saying, they're focusing on the east. And the hope here in Kiev is that there won't be as many missile attacks here, and indeed the hope is they won't attack Kiev at all.
Johnny, as you just pointed out, Russia says the first phase of the military operation is over. Can you tell us what is meant by that and what has been achieved?
Well, I think in the war so far that they planned to win the war in a matter of days. They hoped that the Ukrainian army would capitulate. That hasn't happened, of course. The Ukrainians put up a fierce fight. It's very difficult to know what the Russian plan was. So it's difficult to know whether they've changed plan or whether this was their plan all along. But now, as I said, they are saying that they're going to focus on the east, Donbass and Luhansk. They've said that that's their major war aim, to make these places into independent republics. Right now, they're fighting over Kharkiv and Mariupol. It's difficult to know whether they plan to take Kiev or whether they've changed that plan. But at the moment, the focus is very much on the east of the country.
Now, the stated purpose and the objectives of this military operation, according to President Putin, was to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Has any of the two objectives been achieved?
Well, there's been a lot of strikes. It's difficult to know just how much of the Ukrainian military has been destroyed by Russia. The Ukrainians claim they've killed tens of thousands of Russian soldiers. The Russians themselves claim that that figure is only 1,500. So it's difficult to know in terms of casualty figures and how much military equipment either side has destroyed. NATO, however, is also sending a lot of military equipment. That doesn't seem like it's going to stop. NATO says they're going to continue to send in weapons. So in terms of demilitarization of Ukraine, Russia certainly hasn't achieved that at the moment.
One last thing, Johnny. You said that Russia is going to put its focus on the east and in Donbass region. Considering that this region is already under the control of pro-Russian forces, what is Russia actually planning to do there?
Well, at the beginning of the war, they only controlled about half of Donbass. And Russia said that they want to take over the whole of the historic regions of Donbass and Luhansk. So at the time the war started, they only controlled about half that. They want to take all of that. At the moment, the front line that existed at the beginning of the war is still in place, and Russia have tried to move around the sides and try to circle the Ukrainian army there. And it looks like that's what they're going to try and focus on now, and we may well see a pullback from around Kiev.
Johnny, thank you so much for coming on. Please stay safe. That was Johnny Miller, our correspondent in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Moving on, U.S. President Joe Biden visits Poland to meet with service members and refugees as he appears to suggest that American troops would be sent to Ukraine.
And you're going to see when you're there, some of you have been there, you're going to see women, young people standing in the middle of front of a damn tank, just saying, I'm not leaving. I'm holding my ground.
The White House, however, said Biden has not changed his stance and the U.S. will not deploy forces to Ukraine. During his trip, Biden also once again called Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal. The U.S. currently has around 100,000 troops in Europe, but NATO says the conflict in Ukraine has created a new security reality in Europe, one that will be met with more military spending and more deployments of troops to Eastern Europe. Russia, on the other hand, has repeatedly described NATO's eastward expansion as a threat. A new report has revealed that Russia's allegations over the involvement of the U.S. president's son in financing biological laboratories in Ukraine are true. According to the British news website Daily Mail, emails from Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop show that he helped secure millions of dollars of funding for a U.S. contractor active in Ukraine. The contractor is specializing in researching pandemic-causing pathogens that could be used as bioweapons. Moscow says Washington must explain about Hunter's role in the projects. It has also accused the U.S. and Ukraine of working with pathogens of dangerous infections in 30 laboratories across the country. However, Western countries dismiss the allegations as Russia's propaganda aimed at justifying its military operation in Ukraine. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and political analyst. He says the new findings prove how the U.S. intelligence controls the American mainstream media.
This just goes to show how pathetic the corporate media cartel can be and how infiltrated it is these days by the U.S. intelligence apparatus. I can understand people raising questions about what the facts mean, but to completely ignore the facts is a whole different thing. What these emails establish is that Hunter Biden not only raised funding for a U.S. defense contractor specializing in bioweapons and bioresearch in the Ukraine, but that Hunter and his mates also invested in that operation. And moreover, there are emails which have a senior member of the defense contractor speaking to Biden about how their involvement in this project might be leveraged to assert the Ukraine's freedom or independence, if you like, from Russia and to integrate it into Western culture and the Western economies.
U.S. President Joe Biden has raised eyebrows by saying that a new world order would come in the wake of the Ukraine crisis. He has said, in his own words, the U.S. has got to unite the rest of the free world in doing it. What does this mean? What is apparent is that once the Ukraine conflict ends, the U.S. wants to make sure that it is the one leading the coming new world order, not Russia or China.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New world order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers?
Well, that's it for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Beautiful Nowruz customs in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has its roots in thousands of years ago. Islam respected Nowruz feast, although it rejected superstitions that had been added to it. Furthermore, Islam approves of happiness, but it tries to omit sinful acts from ceremonies and blend every feast and ceremony with remembrance of God and admonishment. In this episode, we are going to talk more about Nowruz traditions in different regions of Iran. Hope you'll enjoy it. The last Iranian month of Isfand is famous for busy bazaars and malls as people rush for buying Nowruz-related items. Everyone wants to make a change in their life. People in different cities and villages of Iran set a tablecloth called haftsin, meaning seven items beginning with the Farsi letter sin, corresponding with S in English. These items include somar, or sumac, symbolizing life and vividness, serke, or vinegar, symbolizing patience, sir, or garlic, symbolizing health and disinfection, senjed, or oleaster fruit, symbolizing love and rationality, sib, or apple, symbolizing health and beauty, samanu, or fresh wheat shoots, pudding, symbolizing sweetness of life, and sabze, or green sprouts of wheat, peas, or lentils, symbolizing freshness, revival, and rebirth. However, it is also believed that sekke, or coin, is also an item in haftsin tablecloth. Moreover, the adherents of Nowruz culture often put other items in the tablecloth, such as colorful eggs, a mirror, a copy of the Noble Quran, and redfish. Many people in various cities of Iran prepare homemade cookies and sweets for Nowruz. Exchange of visits as an important means of training plays an important role in the Islamic lifestyle. This Islamic custom is very significant in reinforcing family bonds and social reform, basically keeping and strengthening bonds with relatives has been highly recommended in the Quran and remarks of Prophet Muhammad and his infallible successors, blessings of God upon them. This highly recommended custom is manifested in material, spiritual, emotional, and psychological helps. Islam has highly stressed family bonds. God says in verse 3 of chapter Nisa, "Worship Allah and do not ascribe any partners to Him and be good to parents." Iranians since old times have been accustomed to exchanging of visits and gathering together. During Nowruz, younger ones often pay a visit to the elderly, as they consider it as a means of acquiring divine blessing. Thus, the grandmothers and grandfathers usually give their grandchildren and children money called AD. According to the Islamic narrations, visiting a brother in faith equals visiting God on his throne. If a faithful solves a problem of his brother in faith, God will solve 70 problems of him on the Day of Judgment. Another nice custom in Nowruz is to make peace between brothers and friends. Islam has highly stressed to give up spites and grudges and reconcile. A famous hadith reads that if two faithful brothers are spiteful toward each other for 3 consecutive days, the spirit of faith will leave them and their worship will not be accepted. In view of this, some people try to act as go-between to make peace between their brothers. Once Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to his companions, "Do you want me to inform you of something better than prayer and fasting?" They said, "Yes, Messenger of Mercy." The Prophet said, "Reconciliation with each other." One of the best ways to spend one's leisure time in Islam is to travel. There are many verses in the Quran which invite people to travel all over the earth to see the signs of God everywhere. Traveling to different places causes us to understand better the realities of creation and to be admonished. For instance, verse 20 of chapter Ankabut reads, "Say, travel over the land and then observe how He has originated the creation. Then Allah shall bring about the genesis of the hereafter. Indeed, Allah has power over all things." The human spirit gets bored of everyday works and it needs renewal of energy and vividness. The arrival of spring and Nowruz festivities provide humans the opportunity to travel and entertain. Entertainment makes the spirit sprightly and helps us pursue our goals in life better. Traveling naturally brings about happiness. This is one of the greatest blessings of traveling. Human psyche and thought grow and thrive through communications. Human beings get familiar with different cultures and traditions via traveling. Traveling adds to one's knowledge too. Well, time is over for this episode. Next time, we will continue our discussion on Nowruz. God bless you.
On behalf of myself and all of my colleagues here at Arabi English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
American families. Addie is 19 years old. She was born in a village in Ethiopia. At the age of 11, after spending some time in an orphanage, she was adopted by a couple from Ohio. Her biological mother hoped to give her a better future. Instead, the story of Addie became the same odyssey as that of hundreds of children adopted by American families and then, after a few months or years, abandoned and transferred to other families. An exchange of children that takes place absolutely privately, in the shadows, outside the control of authorities. A black market of adoptions.
Cases started to surface in the news a few years ago. It's a practice that's gone on for a long time, but it's become a lot more serious in the last 10 or 15 years because of the way the internet has been used to transfer kids, really in some cases, to total strangers. Probably the most disturbing trend and the thing that we're the most concerned about right now is that the internet has become a place where potentially predatory people hold themselves out as families looking to help children. And so you'll see cases where children are transferred by a family no longer willing or able to care for them to a complete stranger without any kind of vetting, without any kind of background check. And oftentimes the child is just put on a plane or put on a bus or dropped off in a parking lot to someone that the family met on the internet, but they have no personal, real-world relationship with.
To adopt a child in America, all you need is a few clicks on the internet. In the meanders of the web, one can find anything. Facebook pages, blogs, specialized websites, people who want to get rid of adopted children, or people who want to find one. And they find one through photos, publicity ads for little human beings.
Sean is 10 years old. He was adopted 4 years ago in Africa. We are looking for a new family because of his difficulty in bonding with his adopted parents. Gillian's adoption is not going well. She cannot overcome refusal and hostility towards her adoptive mother. Jacob needs a new adoption and a new family where he can learn to accept his siblings.
With an all-American hypocrisy, they call them second chance adoption, a second opportunity. If the first adoption doesn't work, that's the philosophy. Who knows, maybe it will work out the second time.
In cases like adoption, even in temporary placement, or even just temporary placement with a friend or family member, you can have an attorney or you can download off the internet a document that says, I'm going to delegate to you my rights and responsibilities. And as long as I have two witnesses and a notary sign this document, I hand the document to whomever I'm giving that rights and responsibilities to. And as long as they keep this document, they can typically make decisions on behalf of the child.
Christine Thurman is an attorney specialized in second chance adoptions. This practice, that is the exchange of children, is absolutely legal in America. To transfer parental authority, one needs only sign a document of a few pages, or even just a few paragraphs.
You can execute a limited durable power of attorney, two witnesses, two individuals, as well as a notary public, which is someone authorized to sign legal documents who's taken a small test and paid a small fee. They execute the document, they'll hand it over to the individual receiving the document. It is not recorded with a clerk of court, it does not go in front of a judge. It is an informal, it's a formal document, but it's an informal process. There's no filing requirement.
It's like a receipt?
It's just like a receipt.
For a kid?
For a child.
But how is it possible that in America, children are exchanged as if they were objects? James Langvin is a member of Congress for the state of Rhode Island. A Democrat, for years has been fighting to put an end to the shame of second-chance adoptions. But until the present, with poor results.
There are laws on the books to prevent rehoming, but a lot of times because these rehomings actually happen under the radar, it's very difficult to track down and to prove that that it's become challenging for law enforcement to actually get their arms around how often this is happening and then actually tracking it down and doing more to protect these children. Not only enforcing the law and trying to bring more clarity and compliance with people who have adopted children and making sure that they can't just easily transfer custody of a child under the radar screen to another family or another individual. We also need to provide the support services that families need so the adoption doesn't fail in the first place. That would be, I think, the best step forward.
The mom, in the beginning, we were fine. After a year later, she's showing the real person who she is and becoming more angrier, punishes me really hard, really bad, the point where I am like not even part of the family. Most of the times, I'll be in the basement by myself. And when she cooks the dinner, I would love to come upstairs and eat with them. And I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to stay in the basement and, you know, just stay there, stare at the walls, basically. I did that for a couple months. And that was the worst day of my life, honestly. I never want anybody go through that.
We fly to Florida, destination Orlando. the Disney World City. Marianne Hewitt is the founder of Love and Hope Adoptions. Her agency deals with consulting and international adoptions, and also second chance adoptions. For many couples, the easiest, quickest, and cheapest way to obtain a child.
There was a family that called us. They were in a panic because there was a show about some of those groups that people were talking on getting shut down. Yahoo didn't know. They were just adoption groups. People were supposed to innocently be talking, and people started to swap their kids. And they called in a panic, oh, those groups are shutting down. We're not going to be able to adopt. You know, we need to adopt through you. And I was like, well, they called because I had a situation. And I said, okay, well, we need this, we need that. Oh, no, our state doesn't need that. I'm like, of course it does. No, we don't need ICPC. I'm like, yes, you do. And then you have to do the post visits. Oh, no, we don't. I'm like, yes, you do. So they didn't want to follow what has to be done, and I didn't work with them. But I have not forgotten them because they have adopted a lot of children just reaching out to people online and not following the legal process. And all the children they've adopted are all children that are a bit disabled emotionally and mentally, which tells me they can even more easily take advantage of them. I just had this feeling it wasn't out of the goodness of their heart because they truly did not want to follow the process.
But sometimes second chance adoptions have a happy ending. In this farm, on the outskirts of Tallahassee in Florida, Shannon and Brian Carroll live with their seven children, adopted in the last 5 years. For them, saving children in difficulty and with past experiences of abandonment or failed adoptions is a mission, a way of fulfilling the will of God.
Lord, we come to you and thank you for today. Thank you for the service that we saw today with prayer. Thank you for our family in general. Amen.
If you're trying to build a family through adoption, if adoptive parents say, oh, I wasn't able to have babies, or we just want one more kid, we're just going to get this fun little kid from China and we're going to build our family, I think you'll find out really fast that these little babies, these kids from traumatic relationship, these children raised in orphanages, they don't know how to act with a mommy and a daddy. They've never had one. They're not going to just come into the house and be like, oh, hi, mom, I love you. If we're adopting these kids to fill a need within ourselves, a need for our kids to love us, it's not going to happen. But if we're adopting these kids to fill a need within them, to be loved, whether they want to be or not, then that's when they can find healing.
Among Carol's seven children, there is Samuel, 9 years old, his face disfigured by a birthmark. He was abandoned when he was 6 months old by his parents. Sam spent his first 4 years in an orphanage in China before being adopted by a family in Michigan. After 4 years, in 2014, this family decided to get rid of him, abandoned once again.
They're like, we need to talk to you. Can you head to your room? So then I'm like, what's it about? When I'm thinking in my mind, oh, it's probably nothing too big, then I realized, oh, okay. You think, okay, I'm here just to, I'm going to be here to stay forever, but the next thing you know, oh, I have to move. Then after a while, you can't really trust them if they say, you're going to stay here for the rest of your life, because you're like, well, I already got moved around this many times, so I guess I can't really trust them. I just had to wait it out and see.
One of the things that Sam first said when he moved here is, oh, maybe my next family will be in Texas. Maybe my next family will be in California. It was just this exciting adventure. But, you know, adventures are only exciting for a season. And eventually he's going to want a family. That he's going to want to know that somebody wanted him. So we had to kind of tell him, hey, kid, no matter how much you like us, you're here forever. We're it. Last stop. There's no other family. It's us.
Addie spent 6 years with her second adoptive family in Wisconsin. Actually, it was a sort of orphanage more than a family. 18 children of all ages. Last year, as soon as she turned 18, she was abandoned again. Another traumatic experience.
The mom always says to me, you need to move. It was all about the moving, move. And I told her, you know, I can't move. I don't have any money to go, or, you know, I didn't have a resource. And I asked her if I could stay longer. And so it was very difficult for her to say yes and you could stay, because she truly wanted me to get out and move so she can get another kid in my spot. They always assured me that won't happen, but they didn't stick with their words still too. So it's just really upsetting to have that, you know. I thought somebody that you cared and that will love you and, you know, that won't do something like that.
Addie found herself drifting without knowing what to do, where to go. Karen Bass is a Democrat MP from California. When she found out about Addie's situation, she decided to help her financially and above all, find her a new home, this time in Los Angeles.
I only know her story, which she said that the house she was living in, the parents decided they wanted new children. They wanted new children! And so they put her out and they put another 18-year-old out and they went to the Ukraine and brought two new children. I connected her with the Ethiopian community in Los Angeles, which is a large constituency in my district. And they found a place for her to live. She's in a job training program now, or about to enter a job training program. And I think she's in a very good situation with the community that has embraced her.
Today, Addie lives with Wasi, who is also of Ethiopian origin, hoping that Addie can find her own way and overcome the traumas of her past. Also, thanks to the contacts found again after years of silence with her biological mother in Ethiopia.
I asked every time, God, why is this happening to me? I just wanted to end this, and why can this pain go away? For years, I went through that pain. The whole thing I've been through all the years is just all punching me in the face, you know? It's just all bad stuff happening. And I just like, what could go better? This is all bad. I just want to just end it, and then life will be better for everybody if Addie's not in this earth. Always had a hope because of my family. Honestly, that's the only thing that kept my head saying, no, don't do it, don't do it. Because I kept dreaming that I wanted to kill myself or doing something really stupid to myself but I know I would be very selfish, because I know my mother and my sibling that loves me, that they will be devastated. So I cannot give that to my family. That really kept me saying, no, 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 no.
But if Addie made it, the destiny of hundreds of children who have had second chance adoptions, gone from family to family, is unknown. There is no data bank, no census, no statistics. Children disappear into thin air, sold, exchanged, swallowed up by a system that is shameful in a civilized society.
In some states, I would say that it is actually far more difficult to adopt a dog than it is to adopt a child. And in fact, one of the things that I've pointed out to Congress is that almost every animal rescue program that I've surveyed actually requires the person adopting the animal to report back to that agency. They are not permitted to rehome the animal. But there are very few restraints in the adoption of children that parallel that animal welfare approach.
We found in some cases that children that have been rehomed have gone to people with criminal records, in some cases even individuals who have had other children taken away from them for a variety of reasons. They've lost their own, their child and taken away because of abuse-related issues, and then they are able to get another child through this rehoming process. That's pretty outrageous.
We've seen cases where children go missing via the internet. They say they're going to a family member and they go missing. They're in the paper. Human trafficking, that these cases set up a very easy scenario for human trafficking of children. You have an individual decide he's going to or she's going to adopt these children, and they get them in their home, and where they go after that, there's no tracking. There's no oversight. There's no follow-up. Unlike if you were to adopt a dog, you might have some follow-up care. You might have a microchip. And I'm not ever suggesting children should be microchipped, but there is no follow-up. We never know what happens to these children.
Because of the experience, honestly, I went through, now I feel like I might not be a good mother, which is so sad because someday I want to be a mother. I always, when I was a little girl, I played with dolls and stuff before this stuff happened to me. But now I'm experiencing not so good things as in what I see in a mom can be very mean and very hard on a kid. So now I experience that. I feel I'm a fear that I might not be a good mother. I want my future be happy. I want to be happy and someday bring all my family, my mom, my sister, my brothers, all live in one big house.
In the limelight.
Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Sues Hillary Clinton, Alleging Plot to Rig 2016 Election Against Him. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has sued Hillary Clinton, the Democratic National Committee, and other people and entities tied to the investigation of Russian election interference in 2016, claiming that, in a bid to rig the election, they orchestrated a conspiracy which made Watergate pale in comparison. The lawsuit came a day after the release of a letter from a prosecutor in New York, who said he believed Donald Trump was guilty of numerous felony violations in his business affairs, despite the district attorney in Manhattan choosing not to indict him. Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton for the presidency in 2016. Nevertheless, 6 years on, he alleges she is guilty of racketeering and a conspiracy to commit injurious falsehood, among other claims. The 108-page lawsuit follows lawsuits filed by Trump and allies in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, charging Joe Biden's victory was the result of electoral fraud. Out of 62 such lawsuits, only one succeeded. Among those also listed as defendants in the new lawsuit are ex-FBI officials James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Sterzog, and Lisa Page. The former British spy Christopher Steele, author of a famous dossier on Donald Trump's links to Moscow. Also, Jake Sullivan, now National Security Advisor to Joe Biden. And John Podesta. Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Florida by lawyers from the state and Alina Haber, a New Jersey attorney who represented Trump in failed lawsuits seeking to block investigation of the deadly Capitol riot on 6th of January 2021, which Donald Trump fueled with lies about electoral fraud. Those lawsuits have widely been seen as delaying tactics meant to help Trump wait out the 6th of January committee until Republicans can retake the House of Representatives this November and kill the investigation. According to the Daily Beast, other attorneys for Donald Trump have complained about Haber's work. Russia denies interfering in the 2016 U.S. election to boost Donald Trump. The U.S. intelligence community claims that Russia did interfere. Robert Mueller, the special counsel who investigated the matter, did not establish collusion between Trump and Russia, but did list 10 instances in which the then president, Donald Trump, may have tried to obstruct justice. Robert Mueller, who explicitly said he was not exonerating Trump, also claimed several connections between Trump aides and Moscow. In August of 2020, a Senate Intelligence Committee report detailed links between Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager for part of the 2016 presidential race, and Russian intelligence operatives. Paul Manafort was jailed on charges of fraud. Donald Trump pardoned him. Regardless, Trump's new lawsuit claims that in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton and her cohorts orchestrated an unthinkable plot, one that shocks the conscience and is an affront to the nation's democracy. The lawsuit alleges, acting in concert, the defendants maliciously conspired to weave a false narrative that their Republican opponent, Donald J. Trump, was colluding with a foreign country. The lawsuit claims the conspiracy involved falsifying evidence, deceiving law enforcement, and exploiting access to highly sensitive data sources in a plot so outrageous, so subversive and incendiary that even the events of Watergate pale in comparison. It claims Hillary Clinton and her fellow defendants nefariously sought to sway the public's trust and work together with a single self-serving purpose – to vilify Donald J. Trump. According to the lawsuit, the deception, malice, and treachery perpetrated by the defendants has caused significant harm to the American people and to the plaintiff Donald J. Trump, and they must be held accountable for their heinous acts. The lawsuit seeks punitive damages, costs and such further, and other relief as this court may deem just and proper. It says Trump has sustained significant injuries and damages, including but not limited to expenses in the form of defense costs, legal fees, and related expenses incurred in an amount no less than $24 million and continuing to accrue, as well as the loss of existing and future business opportunities. Eddie Honig, a former federal prosecutor, now an analyst for CNN, says, "It's difficult to put into words just how deeply flawed and utterly hopeless this lawsuit is." Philip Raines, a former Clinton spokesperson named in the lawsuit, pointed to how damaging an actual trial could be for Donald Trump when he tweeted, "I look forward to deposing the plaintiff." A lawyer for Peter Sturzok, the FBI agent who was fired for sending messages critical of Donald Trump, told the Politico website, "We haven't had a chance to read the complaint, but knowing the former president, there's probably very little in there. That's true." Recently, the New York Times reported a Manhattan prosecutor who investigated Donald Trump's financial dealings wrote in a resignation letter that he believed Trump is guilty of numerous felony violations and blasted the new district attorney for not moving ahead with an indictment of Donald J. Trump. Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, two top prosecutors on the Manhattan District Attorney's criminal investigation of Trump, resigned abruptly last month amid reports that the investigation into the former president's finances was foundering. The newly elected district attorney, Alvin Bragg, was reportedly more skeptical than his predecessor that the evidence his office's attorneys had gathered against Trump would be enough to convict him. In a February resignation letter obtained by the New York Times, Pomerantz wrote that the team of lawyers investigating Donald Trump had no doubt he had committed crimes, and that Alvin Bragg's decision not to move ahead with prosecuting Trump will doom any future prospects that Trump will be prosecuted for the criminal conduct we have been investigating. Mark Pomerantz reportedly wrote, "His financial statements were false, and he has a long history of fabricating information relating to his personal finances and lying about his assets to banks, the national media, counterparties, and many others, including the American people." The clock is ticking on the case against Donald Trump as the current term of the grand jury, which has been hearing